traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi releases pent-up Democratic energy to impeach the president.
And it's absolutely, absolutely essential that the president be held accountable. No one is above the law. It's absolutely essential that he not be reelected president of the United States.
Knowing that impeachment is unlikely, what is their goal?
Because if they do, it goes to the Senate and it's over. They want to drag this out through next year and make sure that they continue to run this president through the mud.
The Senate poses a big hurdle to convicting the president. Senator James Lankford.
The Senate's actually taking this very different than the House. The Senate's heard about the news story, and it said, just get us the facts. The House has not read the report, has not read the whistleblower, has not read the transcripts of the call.
And last weekend's climate strike exposes an insidious deception.
The world over the last 70 years has seen dramatic improvement.
It's official. House Speaker Pelosi, who has skillfully evaded 2 years of impeachment demands from the young and restless congressional freshman, late Tuesday announced an official inquiry to impeach President Trump. But now Ms. Pelosi will have to gather facts, real evidence that the president has actually compromised national security, committed high crimes and misdemeanors. The Wall Street Journal added one more requirement to Pelosi's quest, quoting their piece, quote, she will now have an obligation to fairness. I'm not so sure we'll see that. My colleague Mark Davis from 660 The Answer in Dallas spoke with Texas Congressman Lance Gooden.
So let's go back to pre-Pelosi announcement. You put out a release in the last day or so that essentially talked about your wonderment as how Jerry Nadler can remain as chairman of his House committee. What's that based on?
Okay, so we can't impeach just because we say. We have to actually vote on it. And moving forward to what happened yesterday, Nancy Pelosi did not come out and say, we're going to take up an impeachment inquiry that the House will vote on, which is the proper channel. She just validated what's been going on already by coming out publicly for it. And what that is Jerry Nadler has been running a committee without authorization of the House, and he has initiated an impeachment inquiry. He has stated many times on multiple news channels that we are impeaching the president and we are in an impeachment inquiry. That's just not authorized. So what he's doing is illegal. It's against the rule of law. I think you heard Nancy Pelosi say yesterday that no one is above the law and that the rule of law should always be upheld. Well, if that's the case, Democrats need to practice what they preach and take up a vote on this and authorize this the right way.
So on the merits, Congressman Lance Gooden with us, I looked at her posturing, her move, her it's all words. It's all the dog and pony show now. It has there's nothing official or formal that has really changed at all.
Nothing.
It's just them talking. But them talking is newsworthy. And I wonder if they haven't spoken too early, because here comes the transcript of the president's chat with his Ukrainian counterpart. Here comes the leaker and all of this impeachment kabuki theater.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know about the merits, but it seems to make it wildly premature.
I agree, and I have a feeling that they'll find something to continue down this path on. They always seem to.
It's
unbelievable.
It's a dance move called the Schiff, mm-hmm. in which Adam Schiff says, well, we might not have found anything there, but it raised other vital, urgent, pressing questions mm-hmm. that we simply have to look into.
And they don't really want to impeach the president, not today at least, because if they do, it goes to the Senate and it's over. They want to drag this out through next year and make sure that they continue to run this president through the mud between now and November. And They know that, which is why, and they also don't have the votes. There are 31 Democrats in swing districts that went for Donald Trump. They do not want those Democrats to have to go on record, at least not before Christmas, before they can make a better case in their minds.
But that doesn't mean that this is desirable. It doesn't mean anybody actually wants this, because even a best case scenario, if they continue down this foolish path, is it eats up a ton of oxygen where we'd like to be talking about stronger borders, a stronger economy, constitutionalist justices, and it'll just be harder to do that against the noise.
You're right. And how sad for our country that our president is in New York at the UN, and the leaders that he's meeting with all see impeachment. They all think he's going to be thrown out because people in other countries don't know how the process works. They see the word impeachment and they think, oh, that's the end. So, you know, you've got world leaders who, one, are now questioning our president's staying power, and two, why would they want to have a conversation with him ever? If they know that a secret conversation that they think is private could be out in the press in months.
By midweek, the administration released a transcript of the call that started this latest round of media and Democratic hysteria. The transcript was from President Trump's phone conversation with newly elected Ukrainian President Zelensky on July 25 of this year. Recently, a whistleblower had alleged that the president repeatedly pushed President Zelensky on this call to offer up information on former Vice President Biden. The transcript of the call was released last Wednesday. Mike Gallagher, my Salem Media Network colleague, read the transcript the same morning. He commented on Speaker Pelosi's move.
This is big news. This story is evolving by the minute. I mean, you can't even keep up with the lies and the spin from the media. Reuters had a big headline. Trump's transcript of Ukraine call unlikely to be verbatim. It's probably just going to be pulled together from written notes by people who listen in. No, it's verbatim. It's the whole 30-minute call. CNN, Trump repeatedly pressed the Ukrainian president to investigate Biden. One time in the conversation, one time. CNN thinks one time means repeatedly. They're liars. They're bald-faced, stone-cold liars, and they're lying even in real time. The president tweeted today, will the Democrats apologize after seeing what was said on the call? It got them by surprise. Apologize? They're doubling down. Nancy Pelosi, who's doubling down and admitting she hasn't even read the transcript, and yet she's doubling down. Here's what Nancy Pelosi said. When she said, I haven't even seen the transcript. Listen to what she says here. This was after the transcript was released. Remember good old Nancy? We're going to pass the bill before anybody reads it. We don't want anybody to read it. Heaven forbid I read the transcript that I'm basing my big bravado announcement about impeachment.
I haven't seen it, so I've just come from our own meeting. But the transcript is, the fact is that the President of the United States, in breach of his constitutional responsibilities, has asked a foreign government to help him in his political campaign at the expense of our national security, as well as undermining the integrity of our elections. That cannot stand. He will be held accountable. No one is above the law.
That's a hostage video part two. And you know who she's being held hostage by? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida, we're going to impeach the MF-er. Remember Rashida Tlaib said that the night she was elected? Do you remember that? Election night. We're going to impeach the MF-er. She's a real classy lady, by the way. Do you eat with that mouth? Really? I mean, nice, classy, dignified member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib. We're going to impeach the MF-er. Well, she got her wish. She got her wish. And now this is a giant thud for the Democrats. But this is the one that drives the American people into the arms of the Republican Party. And we're going to see a massive, massive victory in November of 2020. And there's no way it fizzles out. There's no way for the Democrats to unring this bell. Anybody who's saying, well, Pelosi's just trying to, I mean, I understand the analysis about trying to run out the clock and everything. She's going to have to be accountable for this mistake. The Democrats are going to have to own this. You break it, you buy it. Pelosi tried her best to hold off these polarizing, hyperbolic, in-your-face members of Congress. She couldn't do it any longer. They bent her arm so hard, she finally had to cry uncle. And she explains why. Yesterday, before she made the big announcement, she was at the Atlantic Festival on stage. So important to hear this. My ops director, Eric Hansen, minutes ago said, it all makes sense. And they're admitting it. In their mind, they can't stop him at the ballot box next year. And they face four more years of President Trump, more Supreme Court justices, more circuit judges, more border wall, which, yes, is being built as we speak. All the things they hate, we got to stop him. Well, we can't stop him legitimately, so we got to impeach him. Here's Nancy Pelosi, cut number one. This is from this Atlantic Festival where she really let the cat out of the bag.
And it's absolutely, absolutely essential that the president be held accountable. No one is above the law. And separate from the issues, the concerns we're talking about here, that on the policy that we have a clear discussion about whose vision for America is the one we want to go down, and that it's absolutely essential that he not be reelected president of the United States.
Well, you hear that? That's hours before she made the impeachment announcement. It's essential he not be elected. In case you missed it the first time, she doubles down. Same conference, same message.
What's more serious is that he can't win. That is very serious to our country, to us as America.
That's it. He can't win. He can't win. We got to stop him. We can't beat him, so we got to impeach him. Holy cow. I've never seen such desperation in the spin. Mediaite breaks it down with all of these lefties and the corrupt media lying in real time. And there's even some conservatives in there that are wavering, but they're always wavering. Some of the people quoted, they're on the fence. They want to keep everybody happy. They don't take a stand. They don't really like Trump. This is gross stuff. What's gross? The president, the Biden stuff is real.
Coming up.
The Senate's actually taking this very different than the House. The Senate's heard about the news story, but has not met the whistleblower, has not read the complaint, has not read the transcript, and it said, just get us the facts. The House has not read the report, has not read the whistleblower, has not read the transcripts of the call, and it said, let's impeach the president. It's just bizarre what's happening over on the House side.
The Senate resists piling on. Next, on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The line, impeach Trump, has cheapened the term. It has been used so repeatedly by so many members of Congress and the elite media, but it's now clearly just a blunt political instrument that the president's opponents will use when and if they can. The fact remains that only three U.S. presidents have been subjected to impeachment proceedings. To gain clarity on the Senate's role in such matters, I spoke with Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. The Senate voted to demand the whistleblower complaint at the heart of the investigation into President Trump's phone call with the Ukraine president. Did you support that resolution?
I did. That was a unanimous consent, actually, that Schumer brought to the floor. McConnell came and said, we don't object. Everyone is asking for this kind of information, but that's entirely reasonable to be able to get that information. The Senate's actually taken this very different than the House. The Senate's heard about the news story, but has not met the whistleblower, has not read the complaint, has not read the transcript, and it said, just get us the facts. The House has not read the report, has not read the whistleblower, has not read the transcripts of the call, and instead let's impeach the president. It's just bizarre what's happening over on the House side. No one has any facts or details on this. It's reasonable to get the facts. And quite frankly, the White House immediately came out and said, sure, we'll turn that stuff over.
I'm on the opposite side of this because it seems to me that the whistleblower statute is inapplicable to the president when it comes to national security matters. But if he wants to give it to you, fine. I want to ask one specific question about this whole panoply of facts. Hunter Biden, I hate to bring in kids, but he's the predicate here. $50,000 a month for 5 years on a Ukrainian gas board. What could an American who doesn't speak Ukraine bring to a board that's worth $50,000 a month, Senator Lankford?
Not only that, I, by the way, I have no idea. Not only not speak Ukrainian, doesn't speak Russian, doesn't have a background in natural gas or energy development. But suddenly, while his dad is vice president, he ends up having this giant contract with the Ukraine. So there's all kinds of issues here. What I really see what the House is doing is this is an accusation that should come through the normal process. The committee should handle it like normal. There's nothing extraordinary. There are accusations like this that come up all the time. They get dealt with and get put down and say there's no there when they're dealing with the what the president is he accused of doing. What the Democrats did is they spent over 2 years studying Russia, trying to get the facts, and at the end of it, found out there was no collusion, there was no obstruction of justice. Apparently, they're doing the flip this time. We don't need evidence. We don't need details. We don't need background. We're just going to work towards impeachment of the president instead and just jump straight to that rather than try to get any facts at all.
Now, you've got a bill to stop government shutdowns. I like this bill, but I also want the House defense, the defense probes to pass. What does your bill do, and are we going to get a defense appropriation bill?
No. At this point, there won't be a defense appropriation bill until after November the 21st. The
wow.
House has dug in. They refused to do a defense appropriation bill. The Democrats in the Senate have refused to do a defense appropriation bill. We brought the bill up that the House actually passed, and Democrats in the Senate refused to be able to vote for it. Literally, that is the pay increase for our troops. And that is also the stability of all the contracting, all the planning, everything that's going on with Iran right now, everything that's going on with China and North Korea and all the challenges that we have. Those are all loaded into this bill, and Democrats said, I don't want to deal with it. Maybe we'll take it up November the 21st. In the meantime, I do have a bill with Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire that we're trying to work through to end government shutdowns. We've had 21 government shutdowns in the last 40 years.
Last weekend, we saw climate strike demonstrations pretty much everywhere, throughout the U.S. and around the world. The common denominator was that they were youth-driven, and they were outcries against government laxness concerning the climate. Another likely commonality, these youths have come up in schools that teach today's leftist, alarmist orthodoxy on the environment. Here's my Salem colleague, Seth Leibson, afternoon host on 960 The Patriot in Phoenix. He turned to Marlo Lewis, a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Since Friday, the news has been nonstop about climate alarmism led by elementary and secondary school students. Tell us why we should be a little calmer than Greta Thunberg thinks we should be.
Well, yeah, it always seems like the pot has been turned up to the highest boil until the next go-round.
Yes.
And because they've gotten onto this track where their central talking point, it's worse than we thought. So that means that every week it has to be worse than they told us it was the previous week.
Yes, because we're not right.
It's just not that bad, folks. In fact, if you look at the big picture, the world is in a long-term state of continuing improvement. I mean, what amazes me is how many kids have been indoctrinated and how many adults have been misled into thinking that the world is coming to an end. The world, over the last 70 years, which is basically the modern period of global warming, it's usually measured from 1950, has seen dramatic, unprecedented improvements in every major indicator of human health and welfare. Okay, so let's take the most important one, which is life expectancy. Life expectancy since 1950 has basically increased almost by 50%. And that's just astonishing. And then If you actually look at the number of people in the world today, some people think that this is actually a problem, that we have over 7 billion people. But, folks, we couldn't have 7 billion people unless our civilization was highly sustainable and capable of continually increasing the caloric content of food available to the average person. If health care weren't continually increasing so that instead of having more and more sick people as they get older, we have people who are healthier into their old age. If you look at something like malaria, which is a climate-sensitive disease, in other words, mosquitoes do thrive more in warmer climates. Sure. They have faster breeding cycles, and some mosquitoes carry malaria. But the incidence of malaria since the year 2000 has dropped dramatically, and deaths from malaria has dropped dramatically. And if you look at crop yields, of course, the agriculture is probably the most climate sensitive of all industries. And yet, if you look over the last 50, 60 years, and if you look at, you know, just the last 20 years, the major food crops of the world, like corn, wheat, rice, soy, the yields per acre keep increasing all the time.
This is nearly the exact opposite of what the Greta Thunbergs of the world are telling us. She's telling us that money and fairy tales of economic growth are the problem. As I've said in almost every issue that we think of, if we wouldn't have child problems if we didn't have adult problems. Who are and why are the adults doing this to our children and giving them these nightmare scenarios that we are about to engage in a mass extinction? Marlo, are you with me in saying shame on the adults that feed this kind of tripe to children and give them these nightmares?
Yes, and you know, and they've been doing it for so long. My organization just published a book called, well, not a book, but it's a short report that consists almost entirely of newspaper clippings that go back 50 years, and it's called Wrong Again, 50 Years of Failed Eco-Apocalypse.
Listen to the complete interviews with Senator Lankford and Dr. Lewis at townhallreview.com. Coming up, the sexual revolution's somber aftermath.
The university is trying to force Dr. Merriweather to endorse an ideology.
Fighting the liberal steamroller when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Women's liberation and the sexual revolution that hit our campuses 50-plus years ago may not have contemplated the sexual identity dilemma that's come along with it now. In Connecticut, it is robbing females of track scholarships. In Alaska, it's threatening shelters protecting battered women. Lately, it's also been taking away First Amendment rights in our colleges. ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, has been a godsend for our nation as it discourages bullying by governments and institutions of learning. Dennis Prager learned more in his conversation with Travis Barham, senior counsel at ADF.
Tell us about the case you're handling now with a professor at Shawnee State. Is that correct?
That's correct. Dr. Merriweather is a philosophy professor at Shawnee State University. It's in southern Ohio. So in 2018, he was opening his political philosophy class, and a male student raised his hand and asked a question. Dr. Merriweather responded by saying, "Yes, sir." After class, the student came up and said that he identified as a woman and asked Dr. Merriweather to refer to him as a woman going forward. When Dr. Merriweather declined, the student got upset and filed a complaint with the school. Now, Dr. Merriweather was perfectly willing to accommodate the student by referring to him by whatever name he wanted, but that wasn't good enough for the student. It wasn't good enough for the university. The university launched an investigation that ultimately punished Dr. Merriweather for simply refusing to communicate an idea that he doesn't believe to be true. especially in a philosophy class, figuring out what's true and what's real is sort of the essence of the academic endeavor. So Dr. Merriweather remains committed to serving all of his students with respect, but he just can't express all messages or endorse all ideologies.
For me, the $64,000 question is, did that student appear to, if I would have looked at that student, would a reasonable person conclude it was a male or a female?
A reasonable person would have concluded it was a male. That's the way that the student appeared to Dr. Merriweather. Dr. Merriweather had no other information to go on when he first referred to the student. And so the student looked to be male. The student is male. And so, and again, Dr. Merriweather is perfectly willing to accommodate the student by referring to him just by his name, but that's not what the student wanted. The student wanted Dr. Merriweather
his name. What is his name?
We're under orders from the court not to divulge the student's name, but Dr. Merriweather was willing to refer to him by his first name or by his last name, whichever the student wanted, but that wasn't good enough for the university. So really what's going on here is the university is trying to force Dr. Merriweather to endorse an ideology, to endorse a set of beliefs that he doesn't hold. And public colleges simply have no business compelling people to express ideological beliefs they don't hold.
If this person looks like a male, if a person looks like a male, are you supposed to ask at Shawnee State in every case, what do you identify as? Is that the policy?
It's unclear how the university really wants Dr. Merriweather to proceed or all professors to proceed, but it's really making a really bold argument in court. It's arguing that professors simply have no First Amendment rights when they're in the process of teaching their students, something that's unheard of in First Amendment law. Certainly goes against everything that the university stands for in terms of academic freedom. I mean, the whole purpose of a university is to be a marketplace of ideas. But Shawnee State is trying to convert itself into an assembly line for one type of thought.
Now, what did they want to do? Do they want to fire him, censure him? I don't quite follow. What are the repercussions?
So far, they've reprimanded him, and if he has any further issues along these lines, there's a danger that he could be fired or suspended without pay immediately.
By the way, I just want to note for your interest and the interest of my listeners, there is now a columnist at the New York Times whose picture appears at least in the internet publishing of the columns, not on the paper, not in the paper itself. And it's a person with a beard and a mustache. And if you read the ID, it says they, not he or she, they. This is the upside down universe. I just want to say that I asked you what the person looked like, because if you look like a woman, dress like a woman, talk like a woman, and have a woman's name, I don't care what your biological sex is, I will refer to you as ma'am. I am not prepared to invert reality.
And, you know, people can have different perspectives on this issue, but I think we can all come together on the notion that the government should not force someone to change the way he communicates, should not force someone to change his beliefs to match the orthodoxy put forward by the university.
Catch the rest of that conversation and a link to ADF's video at townhallreview.com. Coming up, a republic, if you can keep it.
When we muddle up the separation of powers, it affects real people in real cases and it harms real lives.
Justice Neil Gorsuch, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Justice Neil Gorsuch is the very fine successor to Antonin Scalia. Conservative hearts beat strong, especially when they remember how narrowly they missed losing that seat to a left-wing judge. Justice Gorsuch has most certainly not disappointment on the court, and readers will not be disappointed with his book, A Republic, If You Can Keep It. I found it a delight. Justice Gorsuch joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'd like to begin with the parts of your book that deal with your two mentors, your two justices, Justice Byron White and Justice Anthony Kennedy, because they're both amazing portraits. Justice White is this superhuman human figure, but his walk among the portraits with you is a very memorable part of a republic, if you can keep it. Tell us about that.
Certainly a memorable moment in my life. I was his law clerk about 30 years ago now, and we were walking down the hallway in the Supreme Court of the United States where all the portraits of the former justices hang. And he leaned over to me and he asked me, "Neil, how many of these old guys do you actually know the name of?" And in a moment, I had to realize I had to give an answer that was going to embarrass me. And I said, "Honestly, Justice, about half." And then he said something that really shocked me here. He said, "Me too." And then he said, "And that's exactly how it should be. And I'm going to be forgotten soon enough." And I thought, Hugh, that that was incredibly sad, and I couldn't possibly believe it, because as a kid growing up in Colorado, Byron White was my superhero. He had led the NCAA in rushing while I graduated first in his class from the University of Colorado, top of his class at Yale Law School, clerk to the Supreme Court, Rhodes Scholar, led the NFL in rushing, and was the highest paid football player of his day, Jack Kennedy's friend, helped Bobby Kennedy desegregate the South, and served 31 years on the United States Supreme Court.
Wow.
And I thought, how could anybody ever forget Byron White?
And yet, his prophecy has come to pass, by and large, except among aficionados of the court.
I walk past his portrait every day, and I see tourists and lawyers staring at it quizzically, wondering who he is. And I've come to realize, Hugh, that he wasn't telling me something sad, and he wasn't melancholic about it. He was embracing a truth that he found joyful. He gave up a lot of money. He gave up a lot of prestige and power and fame to serve, because he loved this country and he loved this Constitution, and he knew that the great joy in life isn't being remembered. It's carrying on the torch of our liberties and our Constitution for the next generation. That's what he was trying to teach me that day.
It is a great story in a republic, if you can keep it. And I like the fact that you mix high constitutional theory with some vivid portraits that most people don't get. One more, Justice Anthony Kennedy. Again, you clerked for him, but I believe in the first instance of this occurring on the Supreme Court, you also served with him. And there comes a moment when you are given your first opinion by the bench to write as one of the nine, and it gets circulated for the other eight to either join, concur in, or dissent. Can you tell us the story of what Justice Kennedy did and why he did it?
Hugh, Anthony Kennedy is one of the most kind, civil, decent human beings. No matter when people are beating on him from this direction or that direction, he's always steady and always kind. And for me, this story is what he is all about as a person and as a professional. So, yes, I had the great pleasure of being the first law clerk to serve with his former boss on the Supreme Court of the United States. And I got my first assignment for the court. And as usual, with a new justice, they give you one that they know is going to be a 9-0, and people are going to join up quickly, and it's not going to be a problem. Well, I circulated my opinion late in the day. I'd been working on it all day. The justice had gone home. But when he got wind that I had circulated the opinion, he wanted his law clerk to fax it out to him as fast as possible at his house so that he could be the first to join. He didn't want anybody else to beat him to the punch. Well, his fax machine turned out to be broken that evening, so he had his law clerk drive it out. And later that night, I got a handwritten note from Justice Kennedy joining my opinion. And to me, that's just exactly who he is.
It's one of the touches in a republic, if you can keep it, like Justice Ginsburg returning to you Justice White's handbook on clerks. Is that what we call it?
Well, yeah, kind of, yeah. So when I was Justice White's law clerk, he retired, and his successor was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Justice White put together his law clerk manual, instructions to his law clerks how to run the office, what to do, what not to do. And he had us deliver it over to her new chambers. He wrote some typically humble note saying, "Dear Ruth, here's my law clerk manual. You may find it of use. I don't have much use for him anymore myself." Well, within the first week of my arrival at the court, about 25 years later, I get a note from Justice Ginsburg saying, welcome, Neil. You may recognize some of this. It's what was given to me 25 years ago. I hope I've improved it a little bit along the way.
Now, in your book, Justice Gorsuch, as you did at your appearance at the Nixon Library, you spend a lot of time trying to get non-lawyers and lawyers alike to understand why you have James Madison on the wall of your chambers and why the separation of powers he designed, first for the Virginia Plan and ultimately as it emerged in Philadelphia in 1787, why that separation of powers is so important right now, right today, for everyone listening to this show. Can you tell people why that is?
Well, Hugh, everybody knows how the First Amendment contributes to their liberty, the Bill of Rights. It's kind of obvious, right? But the separation of powers, it sounds like high school civics. And I'm just here to tell you, I think the separation of powers is the key to our liberty, and James Madison knew it. There are great bills of rights around the world. Ours is kind of among the better ones, but maybe not the best. My personal favorite is North Korea's. It promises all the rights you find in our Bill of Rights, plus the right to free education, and even a right to relaxation. But, of course, those rights don't mean anything. They're not worth the paper they're written on, because all power is concentrated in one person's hands. And what Madison knew is that men are not angels, and that the real guarantee for the promises on the Bill of Rights is some enforcement mechanism, and that's the separation of powers. So I am one-ninth of one-third of our federal government, which is one-half of our government in the United States. And you know, all that sounds pretty civics and high school stuff, and it really was to me until I became a judge and I started to see you how when we muddle up the separation of powers, it affects real people in real cases and harms real lives.
To hear my complete conversation with Justice Gorsuch, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Conservatives believe they've got to squelch their opinions in classroom discussions and even in papers that they write.
The importance of viewpoint diversity in the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, progressives attempt to lure Christians leftward.
He said both the Constitution and the Bible are socialist documents.
The 2020 presidential election has a role for believers.
We have to remember where our identity ultimately lies. And it's a lot more complicated than that in practice, but it's also very simple. If we remember that we're Christians first, everything else should fall into place.
We'll also look at how to raise successful teens.
Every parent needs to know this. Satan hates your kids.
And Max Lucado's latest book has a timeless message.
People are longing to be happy in this day and age.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Anyone who's followed the evolution of our colleges and universities over the past 10 or 15 years realizes that they are changing in a big way. Where there used to be vigorous debate and a lively interchange of ideas, now we have groupthink, homogeneity, and a disciplined effort to shut down or shut out opposing views. What we need from faculty and from the student body is viewpoint diversity. One of the key voices advocating for a range of perspectives in the educational experience is my friend, Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. I recently spoke with Pete on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You wrote a piece, Pete, that I wanted to talk to you about, why viewpoint diversity is so important at Pepperdine School of Public Policy. First of all, what is viewpoint diversity?
Well, viewpoint diversity is the concept that different points of political views can be expressed and even encouraged both inside the classroom, in classroom conversations, in written assignments, in test taking, but also outside the classroom in bringing speakers from different political points of view.
Now, you write that it's a graduate program that cares deeply about preparing public leaders who can work across differences to find common sense solutions. You bring all points of view and you look for a student body that is going to be what, left to right on the spectrum, young to old on the age axis, Democrat and Republican, red and blue.
Exactly. I mean, we're a fairly young program in the sense that the average age of our graduate students is around 25 or 26 years old. But even though I would consider ourselves really one of the only thoughtful, conservative graduate schools in America, our student body is actually pretty diverse. We just did a survey of our incoming class, and it's really across the board, maybe a little bit more conservative than not. But we certainly welcome progressive students because we understand that the world that these students are going into, especially for our grad students, are all going into government or public service of some sort. They're going to have to understand how the other side thinks.
You've got a Harvard Crimson study here. 78% of Republican graduates said they withheld their political opinions in class during their time at Harvard. I would never have thought not to voice my point of view, but I had people who would have, you know, despised silence. What has happened?
Hugh, this is a point I always try to get across when I talk about viewpoint diversity, especially to older audiences. There's been a radical change in what's going on in our classrooms just in the last 15 years. Essentially, what we've seen demographically, and there are numerous studies to back this up, we've seen the baby boomer generation come into positions of leadership following the greatest generation in academia. But as I speak on more college campuses and speak to kids that are coming into our program as graduate students, coming out of really good undergraduate programs, conservative kids across the board, and this Harvard Crimson study, they do it every single year of their graduating class, is really just representative of what I'm seeing in so many great undergraduate programs where conservatives believe they've got to squelch their opinions in classroom discussions and even in papers that they write.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
If you've been hurt by a truck, you can call Colombo Law 24/7, and we'll be there to make sure you're taken care of. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.